Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Clayton Boyce and I'm president of the National Press Club and news editor with the Knight Ridder Tribune News Service. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers. On Thursday, September 23rd, Speaker of the House Tom Foley will discuss congressional reform. On Tuesday, September 28th, General Colin Powell will give his last speech as Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I'm afraid to announce that that is already sold out. And on Wednesday, September 29th, Representative John Dingell, Chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, will discuss health care reform. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include the Secretary General of NATO, Manfred Werner, Labor Secretary Robert Reich, Chairman and CEO of Amgen, Gordon Binder, and author Stephen King. Audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table and pass them up to me. I'll ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called, and please withhold any applause until all the names are read. From your right, Kenneth Cavender, writer for Miss Manners and Company, the TV series. Jennifer Lawson, Vice President for Programming, Public Broadcasting Service. Kevin Keene of Thompson Newspapers. He is also the chairman of the club's entertainment committee, which is why we have him here today. Katie Kelly, feature writer for USA Today. Vera Glasser of Maturity News Service. Dr. Robert Martin, the husband of our speaker. Christy Wise, freelance writer and vice chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. David Hendon, agent for Ms. Manners. Gordon Smith, member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee, who arranged today's luncheon. Diane Lovey, Vice President and Executive Editor, United Features Syndicate. And Sharon Rockefeller, President of WETA. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, and Melanie Abdo-Dermott for organizing today's luncheon. Judith Martin, better known as Ms. Manners, is today's guide through the minefield of society. She is speaking today on the etiquette of the press, something that I didn't know existed until we received word that she was going to speak on it. And I should mention that I'm the last person to be introducing Ms. Manners and moderating this program, because I can tell you what I know about manners. If I go to a fancy dinner with all that silverware there, I am never sure which fork to use properly as a double for a back scratcher. And lest anyone think good manners, civility, with touches of courtesy and humility, are not for members of the press, I can tell you Ms. Martin disagrees. It all starts with parents who worry about what will happen to their civil children, assuming there are some of those, when they go off into the uncivil worlds of the media and business. Fellow columnist Jonathan Yardley pointed out recently that a private school in Baltimore is instituting a curriculum in civil behavior. I'm sure Ms. Martin would say, hooray. Maybe good manners are catching on, with the generation to whom nobody has ever said no. Ms. Martin says that ours was not a country noted for its good manners, Emily Post notwithstanding, when she started her column in 1978. It has been an uphill job, she says, to place her column into the more than 250 newspapers that carry it today. She emphasizes that manners are not just for rich snobs. They are for everybody. Her authoritative words will reach even further very soon through a program to be carried on public television. The first one will air on WETA in Washington on Sunday evening at 7:30 p.m. She's already a guest commentator on National Public Radio's Morning Edition. Ms. Martin's scope is pretty wide, and she gets a lot of mail, which is often the source of her witty commentary. She averages about 300 letters a week. Syndicated since 1978, she has written three big books on etiquette in her spare time. By reading her, we can find out how to conduct a polite affair. Ms. Martin is a realist, it says here, as well as how to advance civilization by our conduct at the dinner table or at the White House. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the National Press Club, Judith Martin, Ms. Manners.
Thank you very much. I understand that when I was invited here, there were some who cherished the hope, who were praying, that I would give it to the press for having disgraceful manners. Who, me? I'm a lifelong journalist. Is there anything wrong with journalist manners? If there are any little graces that you feel are lacking, I hope you will tell me about them later, because I'm sure all journalists will want to correct them. But I came here to give you a report from the Etiquette Beat. Now, I suspect you think that I'm the only person on the Etiquette Beat, that everybody else is concerned with something called real news, the important things that happen. And I'm supposed to worry about the trivial aspects of life, things that don't really matter, like eating or getting married, and stay out of the good stuff, like sex and violence. But I can't, because it is impossible to understand important issues without recognizing the etiquette factor. So I want to talk to you about the etiquette angle of the news. I'm not claiming that all of life is an etiquette problem, although I've had days like that, and so have you. I'm not even claiming that all bad behavior is bad manners. Crime is not merely lethal rudeness. But I am claiming that you can't leave etiquette out of the equation if you want to analyze human behavior in all its newsworthy variety. And yet people do. If they acknowledge that etiquette has any place in modern life, they consider it a dispensable frill. I mean, don't we all believe in behaving naturally? We encourage people to express what they truly believe, to stand up for their rights, and to act on their feelings. And they do, only some of them are armed, both on the domestic front and in a few foreign spots we could name. And even when they're not armed, they manage to cause a lot of trouble, or as we say in the business, news. I'm sorry to say that the press does not usually recognize that an etiquette problem exists until the President of the United States throws up on his host at a state dinner. And actually, that was less of an etiquette problem than you may have thought, because there's a rule: if you're going to do something awful, make it obviously uncontrollable and so awful that people can't possibly disapprove, because they're all paralyzed, thinking with horror, what if that had happened to me? But I hope everyone now realizes that the major news event of this summer, and perhaps some time to come, was the performance of an act of symbolic etiquette, which is to say an arbitrary symbol codified by etiquette and universally understood, multiculturalism notwithstanding, this part is essential that everybody recognize it. And this news event coming to you straight from the vocabulary of etiquette was a handshake. Would there have been the same emotional effect if all the 10 million people watching had just been given copies of the peace agreement to read? I don't think so. Those emotional symbols of the etiquette vocabulary have enormous impact on people. Now, personally, I think things might have cleared up a lot sooner if the people involved weren't afraid that if they made peace, they'd have to kiss and hug. But let's talk about domestic issues, crime. The etiquette of even talking about crime has changed dramatically in recent years. You know, there's a general perception that manners are always going downhill. This is a case where they have leapt forward into politeness, maybe even beyond politeness. For example, there's that very polite term, a cry for help. That's what we used to call a crime. The cry for help used to be what the victim uttered. And what the polite victim now utters is sympathy for the person who did it as being obviously sick. And it's considered polite to deny any desire for revenge by saying, my only concern is that what happened to me not happen to anyone else. Now, I am a great defender of compassion and euphemism, but this routine still needs a little work. I am very disappointed in the manners of the criminal element because they are throwing new blame around by complaining that the victim or society should have noticed the problem before the cry for help and solved it. And while their families now politely say that they suffer for the families of the victim, they then spoil it by going on to say that they're suffering too, so why don't we all just call it even? There is a clear violation of precedence here. The victim gets the first helping of sympathy. If you hear that a group of school children has been gunned down while they're playing hopscotch, you're supposed to say how awful and then their poor parents before you talk about the unfortunate predicament of the person who did it. It's a question of precedence. Let me dig deeper, though, into the question of crime. What are some of the causes? Now, I follow the news very carefully, so I know that the number one cause of violent crime is senselessness. Another senseless crime is being committed. We hear that every day. We used to have sensible crime. What went wrong? Well, sensible crimes were ones that were committed for love or money, items everybody understands and everybody wants more of. But some of those other senseless crimes would make equal sense to anyone who realized that there is another craving for something that is in especially short supply nowadays, and that is politeness. Respect is as coveted as love or money or fame or sneakers. People get desperate when they think they're being deprived of it. Dissing, showing real or apparent disrespect, is cited as a motive in an amazing number of violent crimes. Now, I suppose I don't look to you like much of an authority on urban street crime. So let me just read you an analysis by someone who is not corrupted by the etiquette business, a junior at Anacostia High School here, who was quoted in a front page story 2 weeks ago when one of his classmates was murdered. And he said, "The biggest thing everybody is looking for is respect on the streets. It isn't money. They're just trying to make sure you respect them. People are just pushing each other to the maximum to get respect, and the maximum is death." Respect. This is a mere attitude that not the law but etiquette requires in our treatment of one another. He is saying that people will kill for that courtesy. Now, as a matter of fact, this is not really new. People in many cultures have killed for a perceived lack of respect. But since the procedure used to involve gloves, not for wearing, but for smacking across the face, and there were warnings and rules, in other words, etiquette, it was seen as rather snazzy and upper class. This is the same thing, it's just a little more widespread. And it's not the only crime-provoking etiquette violation these days. People still crave the minor courtesies that are no longer commonplace. Highway courtesies. Just a week or so ago, the Virginia State Police pointed out, after yet another shooting on I-95, that a lot of drivers now are using guns to encourage good highway manners. They do this by shooting into the cars of people who have disobeyed etiquette rules, such as yielding the right of way or not annoying others with loud radios. The question of waiting one's turn and taking turns. Also this summer, two people broke into the checkout line in a Bethesda grocery store and somebody got stabbed. These are crimes committed in retaliation for etiquette violations or in retaliation for rudeness that was in itself a reaction to an etiquette violation. So are you going to tell me that nobody takes etiquette seriously except me? Now, I realize I must sound as if I approve of all these nice people who are going around punishing etiquette violations. Actually, they are not in my service. The hardest point I have to get across, even to law-abiding people, is that you cannot go around punishing rude people with even more devastating rudeness, much less with violence. Folks, this doesn't help the cause of etiquette. Etiquette is not equivalent to sainthood, an idea that undoubtedly discourages a lot of people from practicing it, but it does require the restraint in response that it is asking of other people. The point I'm trying to make is that even rude people, even outlaws, have a deep-seated expectation of their right to be treated courteously according to these artificial rules of etiquette that we have developed by other people. They just don't think that they have to treat other people that way. That's the part I'm working on. But no matter how low the level of etiquette sinks, there is still that sense of entitlement about being treated according to our understanding of good manners, and people are killing for it. Well, that was violence. Let's talk about sex. Sexual harassment. Obviously, deliberate sexual harassment has to be handled by the law. The modern equivalent of the villain who is only too happy to have it in his power to foreclose the mortgage if the heroine doesn't come across has to be turned over to the law. You cannot fight crime with etiquette, although for too long society refused to untie the heroine from the railway tracks on the grounds that if she were properly behaved, she could charm her way off. I may have thrown in too many plot elements here, but... What about men of goodwill who are confused about distinguishing harassment from what is or once was socially condoned behavior? There's where the interesting problem lies, not among the villains, but among the people who are confused about change. Now, we did have a transition period for those who were used to the bad but permitted manners of the past. The people who claimed that they didn't know that their female employees were not flattered to be told how well they filled out their clothes while they were in the middle of asking for a raise. But during that transition period, businessmen have learned to allow businesswomen to pick up their luncheon checks. So we know they're trainable. Gentlemen, the transition period is now over. There's actually a very simple rule for professional behavior. That is, it's simple in theory, anyway. You are not supposed to notice gender on the job. This is counterintuitive, but there it is. Rank may affect how you treat people on the job, but gender does not. But sometimes gentlemen, or even ladies, have honorable intentions. We do want to perpetuate the human race, and everybody claims to be doing too much overtime to do it, manage it anyplace else. So what are we going to do? In courtship, someone has to take the initiative, and the person who makes the first move has no guarantee that it's going to be welcome. So I am allowing one overture, which is, would you like to get together after work? Yes, and you switch after hours to social manners. One no, and that's it. No second chances. But what about just being friendly when there's no intention of romance? Aren't we always saying that we want our workplaces and the businesses that we patronize to be friendly? And isn't there the possibility of that being misunderstood? Is it really possible that there are professional situations in which friendliness is not a welcome addition? Well, I'll tell you who thought not. The Texas judge who drew a happy face on somebody's execution order not long ago. Why not just brighten someone's day by being a little bit more friendly? Actually, what we want is not friendliness, but a pleasant and cooperative demeanor that is not personal, which is called professionalism. Is a professional demeanor artificial? Sure. But so are those phony friendships in the office that lead to social harassment, like the daily office collection for people who are having baby showers and birthdays. Polite work time manners require people to keep a pleasant, formal distance. Why is it that the only people who seem to understand this are the people in the office who really are having an affair and don't want anybody else to know? The law bars only unwelcome sexual attention at the workplace, which is why we need an etiquette factor here, because what about welcome sexual attention at the workplace? Welcome to whom? The boss who's paying for their time? The customer who's waiting to be waited on? During the height of the debate about gays in the military, somebody suggested that maybe there was a difference between being on duty and being off duty. And this is a great idea for everybody, no matter what their private life. And that's why we call it private. It doesn't mean that you can't admit that you have someone to come home to. It means that nobody goes around asking for approval or handing out judgments. We should modify don't ask, don't tell, and make it don't supply the details and don't offer an opinion. Because the fact is that hardly anyone approves of anyone else's romantic choices, no matter how conventional they may be. You can go to the most suitable wedding in the world, and half the people there are thinking, what on earth does she see in him? And the other half are thinking, well, what does he see in her? But if they are polite, they will keep these thoughts to themselves, and that is the secret of dealing with all of these issues, a little etiquette rule called minding your own business. It is a wonderful thing. Hasn't been practiced in some time. We prudish Victorians had a little saying called, do what you like in private, just don't scare the horses on the streets. But etiquette does nose into people's private lives when it comes to the issue of child rearing. We have to, because child rearing is passing on the manners to the next generations, and we would like to see some child rearing. When you look at all the unspeakable, unnatural acts that children are now charging their parents made them do, why do normal parents think that they can't make their children learn to say please and thank you? Part of the problem, I think, is that nobody wants to be identified as an older generation. I see it in the distaste for any forms of etiquette that serve to make a distinction between adults and children. Why isn't it considered fun to grow up and assume adult manners and privileges and sophisticated clothes and to get to push the children around? Isn't that why we had them? But I have news for the adults who think that it's very cute to tell young people, oh, don't call me Mrs. or Mr. So-and-so, you make me feel old. The young person does not then think, oh, how silly of me, I made a mistake. This is a young person like me. That person thinks, well, you are old. And if that's the effect you want to achieve, that's the way you're doing it. Otherwise, you might as well accede gracefully to the fact that we need an older generation, one that is obviously, symbolically and otherwise, in charge. In requiring respect, parents teach that concept of respect that is missing from our society, and that Anacostia student and I think is essential. The lack of manners in children is probably the most important factor in education news, where it's called discipline. Even for small children, etiquette, I'm not ordering wine, but the ability to sit still for 3 minutes, to refrain from hitting other people as a first response, To wait until their turn to talk to respect the teacher is a prerequisite for any other form of education. Ask any teacher. And that goes for big students too, by the way, free speech notwithstanding. The free speech issues are in a really peculiar state these days. We are all for free speech. And yet, the debates have led one side of the political spectrum to defend bigotry and the other side to defend pornography. I mean, really? Has nobody heard that saying of etiquette, there's a time and a place for that? Taste, discretion, I know you know the word, but please don't say it in front of your grandmother or in front of the children. Don't say things that hurt people's feelings. You can express your views all you want, but keep a civil tongue in your head. Now, I want to stress that this is an etiquette question because it should not be a legal question. One of the problems of an etiquette-free society is that people who get fed up with the low level of behavior keep trying to pass laws against it. And that is a mistake. I am not for any laws that abridge free expression. This has to be handled on the level of etiquette where people refrain at certain times and places from expressing themselves in ways, I'm not talking about content here, that interfere with legitimate activities. And yes, that means that organizations, including universities, ought to be able to say you cannot participate unless you are willing to comply with their reasonable rules. Reasonable because they cannot operate without them. You know, we take this for granted in our court system. Even when a case upholding freedom of speech is being fought, total free speech is not allowed in the courtroom. You can't use obscenities, you can't talk out of turn, you can't be disrespectful. You have to stand up and sit down when they tell you to. Especially in professions where there is strong conflict, legislatures, which go by that etiquette book called Robert's Rules of Order, or sports, which have their rule books and their umpires who serve on as on-the-spot Miss Manners is. The etiquette is extremely strict, not only in regard to speech, but to dress and physical demeanor, because you cannot accomplish the task at hand otherwise. The purpose of the university is not to protect all forms of free speech, but free inquiry. And when you have mayhem and personal insults, people cannot pursue the truth. Now, I am not the only person who has noticed that something is needed between uninhibited natural human nature in all its glory and the harsh restraints of the law. There are more and more cries in op-ed pages, in columns, discussions, and professional societies for civility, common sense, consideration, treating others as you wish to be treated, making everyone feel comfortable, fairness, good sportsmanship, gentlemanly behavior. I never say ladylike behavior. Why is that considered wimpy when gentlemanly-like behavior is still considered proper? But just when I get my hopes up that those who call for civility are on my side and are going to help me with this cause, they all hasten to add explicitly, well, that of course they don't mean etiquette. Etiquette sounds so finicky, as if you really meant it seriously. And they're afraid that etiquette is snobbish, artificial, prudish, hypocritical, and old-fashioned. Well, as a matter of fact, snobbery is bad manners, so that's a bum rap right there. Artificiality is another story. Given what natural behavior is like, as we've all seen, we should all be grateful for a little better than natural artificiality once in a while. Prudishness we could certainly use a little more of, if only to restore that delicious state of being shockable. A lot of fun that I think people miss nowadays. Hypocrisy can be very refreshing if it means that people might say something nice to you once in a while instead of telling you frankly and honestly what they think of everything you eat, do, weigh, and fall in love with. And old-fashioned is just not a term that scares me as much as it's supposed to. As a matter of fact, etiquette evolves and changes all the time in response to philosophical and technological changes. And guiding those changes is a lot of what I do. There are people who think, oh yes, they can use their cellular telephone at the concert because I haven't yet gotten around to passing a rule against it. Oh yes, I have. And I noticed that people who are quick to charge that etiquette is old-fashioned do this in a highly selective fashion. They say it's out of date to have to write thank you letters, but they don't ever come up and say it must be out of date for them to receive presents or invitations. Anyway, I am insisting that we use the word etiquette, and not only because it makes everybody squirm, although surely I'm entitled to my pleasures too. Etiquette is the right word for the extra legal rules of behavior, the symbolic system, and the rituals of a society. It's a tough word that allows no nonsense about being allowed to decide for yourself what is proper behavior. This has to be a common language that everyone understands. Besides, do you really want me to let people use their own judgment and make up their own rules? I mean, have you seen what they come up with? They congratulate new parents by asking them, "Was this an accident?" They treat weddings as fundraisers. And they console the bereaved by assuring them that the death was the fault of the deceased for not being in better health, or not having a more positive attitude toward whatever disease killed him, and that everyone's better off now anyway. And then if anyone is driven to tears by this kind of condolence, they are congratulated on being working through their grief. The word etiquette also clearly distinguishes rudeness from crime. Etiquette consists of rules, not laws. Compliance with it is voluntary, and the only punishments for flouting it are social disapproval and exclusion. Being considered unpleasant to have around may be something of a social and professional disadvantage, but hey, it's not jail. And lastly, etiquette, being a nice old-fashioned term, is obviously not a new restriction on our liberties. Manners have always been a factor in all aspects of civilized life, even journalism. Thank you.
Stand up again, and there are a lot of questions about the etiquette of the press, so I'll begin with that and move into general subjects later on. First of all, what makes you the expert on etiquette of the press?
What makes me the expert? Well, it's sort of like Napoleon. You have to crown yourself because there's no one else of sufficient rank to do it.
I have to mention that your husband told me that he taught you everything you know.
So. Such a gentleman. Ever the gentleman, Robert.
Does the press act like they have no manners? I know you indicated otherwise during your speech, but perhaps it was tongue-in-cheek.
Let me say two things about this. There is, of course, a difference between professional manners and social manners. And very often people try to catch reporters as if they were being rude socially when they are doing a perfectly polite job of exercising their professional tasks. The people who think, well, it's rude to press a high official to answer a question he doesn't want to answer. No, it's not. That's what we're supposed to be doing. It would be rude to state it rudely, but not to do it. And a lot of reporters have been skewered on that. Aren't they being terribly rude when they're not? On the other hand, there are people who have not learned that not only when you ask a stupid question, you get a stupid answer, but when you ask a rude question, you get a rude answer. I think this is a bit self-defeating. And a question such as, how did you feel about seeing your child killed in front of your eyes, is a rude and stupid question, which nowadays is getting more and more rude answers as people catch on to the fact that they don't have to answer the press questions, which should be a big incentive for us to be polite. There are more effective as well as more polite ways of asking such questions. The person who says, this is a terrible tragedy, is there a lesson for society in it, is going to get an answer.
Do you hope to change the manners of the press, or are you on a crusade here?
I am trying to change the manners of the universe, of which I realize the press is the most important part, and perhaps where I should start, but everybody.
Who in the news business represents the finest in etiquette, in your view, and why?
All of you here today. Which is a way of saying to go around critiquing other people's manners, like a meter maid, even if I were handing out citations, favorable ones, as well as tickets, would be rude.
Who are your role models today, and who were your role models in beginning your column?
It is a little bit hard to figure out role models when you're doing something that everybody in the world says, why on earth are you trying to do that? Who cares about etiquette? Which was the state of affairs when I started to write about it. I have read etiquette books all my life, and you might be surprised at what I classify as etiquette books, like the Bible, for example. Which is full of wonderful things about how to behave, philosophy, history, and so on. Am grateful for the tradition of the past, which is a large part of etiquette. But etiquette had, unfortunately, when I stepped into it, gotten to a, you might say, very polite but rather useless phase where people in the etiquette business were saying, well, just do whatever makes you feel comfortable. Which is very nice, but then you wouldn't have asked, would you?
This is a follow-up to a previous question. Should the press shout at the president at the helicopter pad?
You may well ask, should the president be running that noisy helicopter while you're trying to ask questions?
How do you feel about four-letter words in the newsroom? And I assume that you've heard a few in your long career.
They have four-letter words in the newsroom? Oh, my goodness.
There are a couple questions about dealing with last names. The first one is, as a female journalist, I am irritated when I call an office and the secretary calls me by my first name, although we have never met. How do I squelch this politely?
As you ought to have the privilege of asking someone to call you by your first name as a sign of friendship, intimacy, and so on, you also have the privilege of asking them to call you by your last name and by a courtesy title. And I hope people will exercise this. We talk about sincerity in manners. Americans pride themselves on not being phony. This instant friendship, everybody is buddies all the time, is very phony, and let us put a stop to that.
How did you get into the etiquette dodge, as this questioner says? Was the idea your own or some perceptive editor's?
I would not slander any editor by claiming that an editor in 1978 would come up with the idea of somebody covering etiquette. I came up with it myself to the horror of the people whom I told it to, who were then gracious enough to wait until I had written a column and then were very encouraging. If you will cast your minds back to 1978, when I started this, people were saying, etiquette, who needs etiquette? Because they were apparently very happy with rudeness.
Is technology somehow undermining our common courtesies and manners?
Technology is a tool, and it can be used politely or it can be used rudely. There are many wonderful inventions. People used to try to get me to denounce the answering machine before it became ubiquitous. Well, there are a lot of us who can't afford a butler. It's very nice to have an answering machine doing that job. Actually, it was the telephone that was rude in expecting people to drop everything, no matter what else they were doing, and attend to it. Technology can be the servant or the bane of etiquette, and that is why I have to keep issuing these new rules to keep up with it. But I am certainly not against the advances of technology. It was very wearing to have to go around with a horse and carriage leaving cards on people when you could use email.
Speaking of email, about technology, is there an etiquette for computer communication like email, of course excluding the hackers?
Not excluding the hackers. I get a lot of mail from hackers who are concerned about computer manners and people on network systems and so on. Questions of people who clutter up the network, who use obscenities and other terms that offend people who are on the network, and so on. Of course, there are manners to go with it. Some of them can be adopted from correspondence, others from public discourse. But yes, manners for computers.
When I referred to hackers, I meant people who look into files they're not supposed to look into. So I think that's what the questioner had in mind. What will you do on your new television show? Take phone calls from viewers?
I had an audience present. In fact, several audiences. So many people showed up, we had to rotate them through, and we dealt with their etiquette questions, which, of course, is something I love to do.
As I look out at the audience, this questioner says, my wife tells me that there are more women than men here. Is this a reflection on the state of manners today, or the state of men?
It's interesting that in the United States, etiquette has been considered the domain of women, as opposed to England and France, where it was those guys with the long lace cuffs and the finicky ways and the quick swords to start duels. To the extent that when men are behaving badly, people say, aren't the women awful to allow them to behave like this? The domain in which women have presided was attributed by Arthur Schlesinger Sr., who collected etiquette books, the father of the present historian, Arthur Schlesinger, to the scarcity of women on the frontier, that they were able to insist that they be treated properly because they were fewer of them, and bodes well for the next generation but one in China, where there'll be, unfortunately, an uneven population. The mail that I get reflects all generations and both sexes, which was originally something of a slight surprise to me. I thought it was just going to be all the old cranks like me saying, yeah, you get them, you tell them. Gentlemen are extremely confused, and well, they might be, about changes in the society, a lot of which were led by women and necessitated changes in manners that men are struggling to catch up with. And so it has become a subject that involves everybody, as indeed it should be. I mean, etiquette was something that Socrates was asking the question, how should men live? We've just made it, how should men and women live? But philosophers over the years, figures of religion, leaders, social leaders of all kinds, have been preoccupied with this question of how should we live? And it affects us all, and people are beginning to realize that.
Do you plan to go international with your column or with your show?
The column is somewhat international. It does run in other countries. I had been puzzled by the fact that it had run all these many years in Japan, and I had never gotten a letter from Japan. All the other papers, I will get tons of letters. And I started asking around among Japanese friends, why do you think that is? And there were various explanations, and somebody said, well, I think a lot of people read the Japan Times to work on their English, and maybe they're afraid of writing a letter, or maybe they think it's not quite polite to do so, and so on. And then finally, one day, the letter came. And the letter was, if you are doing business in New York from Tokyo, do you say good morning or good evening, depending on what time it is in Tokyo or what time it is in New York? I hope there'll be others to come. But in any case, the column does run elsewhere. The answer is that you greet the person according to his or her own time zone, because otherwise half the conversation and a lot of your long distance money is spent with a person saying, "What? What did you say? Did I miss something?"
When dealing with people from other nations, is it what should you do? Study their etiquette before you meet, or hope for the best?
Well, there is such a thing as, which I advise, called playing the stupid foreigner, where people make allowances that you do not know all the nuances of their behavior. Of course, you try to learn as much as you can about other people's manners, but there are places where it is so highly complicated that if you do something just a fraction off, you will be inadvertently insulting someone, in which case it is very advisable to have this big sort of stupid grin and I'm just a foreigner, what do I know? But a lot of people think you can simplify it down to the rule of when in Rome, do as the Romans do. You don't always, if you remember your history, want to do as the Romans do. There are questions where manners go on a continuum, the other end of which is morals, and there's also a moral basis for manners of restraining yourself for the community good. When there are issues of manners that obviously play into moral issues or national issues, then you do not follow the foreign manners. A prime example would be, I was horrified when there was an American chief of protocol who curtsied to British royalty on the grounds that we fought a war on this issue and we won, so why should backtrack now? And as a matter of fact, the British do not do this. Sir Harold Nicholson, the diplomatist, wrote about the great effort that the British made in China to avoid kowtowing to the Chinese emperor, because he was not their emperor. There are manners issues where people would be treated against what we would consider a dignity that has moral undertones for us in regard to one's gender or race or whatever that we do not go along with. But we do try to otherwise to observe the niceties and not disgust our neighbors when we travel.
This is a hypothetical situation. Let's assume that you are the head of state, perhaps the United States.
Thank you.
And you're in Tokyo for a state dinner. And you're seated next to the Japanese head of state and you're about to be violently ill. What is the proper thing to do?
Actually, under the circumstances, I think the president behaved pretty well. He dove under the table. There are moments in life like that. What else can you do? It's very easy for us to say, don't be sick, say excuse me and run down the hall and so on. But when you're totally out of control, go under the table and then come up laughing.
Do you center many or any of your columns on the etiquette for teenagers, and would they be responsive?
Of course I do, and I get an enormous amount of mail from teenagers. It is commonly thought in the so-called elder generation, people who tell you not to make them feel like their parents, that teenagers are not interested in etiquette. Take a look at any teenage group in a high school, a street gang. Where are there more rigid rules about how to dress, the pecking order, how to speak, how to behave? They would make a turn-of-the-century British butler look laid back. People, of course, are interested, and teenagers are extremely interested in how to behave. Their parents have done them no service by saying, even out of the kindness of their hearts, that they should just be themselves. Do whatever you want. This is no help. And a lot of our problem in the lack of passing on manners to the younger generation has come from parents who were not neglectful, who had the best intentions in the world, but thought that it was wrong and inhibiting to teach manners to their children. And as a matter of fact, the opposite is true. There is nothing more inhibited than a child who is in a new position, doesn't know what is expected of him or her, or how people are going to take this behavior, who doesn't know how to behave. Telling a child, just go out and be yourself, it doesn't matter, would be like sending your child out on a soccer field and say, oh, just get the ball, don't worry about, there are no rules, just do whatever you feel like. Child is going to be killed. And children realize this. I get an enormous amount of mail from teenagers, from people in their 20s. The missing ingredient is you need the factor in order to be interested in manners of caring what other people think of you. So when you're 2 years old, you really don't care as long as they respond to your cries. When you have reached puberty, you do care. And that's when I begin to hear from people.
There were several questions about your comment on asparagus before the lunch began, which will make no sense to people who are watching this on C-SPAN. But could you address that question again? Because I assume you were speaking tongue-in-cheek.
You assume I was speaking tongue-in-cheek, my good man. I do not jest about serious matters of this nature. Asparagus is actually a finger food. We had it for a first course here. It does not have to be. You may use your fork. You may even use asparagus tongs, which I assume you all have. I have them. Which are nice little silver gadgets that, if you're not using them to playfully tweak the noses of people who think you're joking, you use to pick up asparagus. But it may perfectly, properly be eaten with the fingers. And besides, it's such fun, because if you go to a serious, pretentious restaurant and you start doing this, everybody whips around and they say, that lady is eating asparagus with her fingers. And then I hope when they get home, they look it up and they, oh, it was right.
This questioner asked about dressing on asparagus also, but let's move on.
Well,
I don't want to reveal
it. Maybe
anymore.
We ought to say, if it's going to dribble on your shirt, use some judgment.
I don't want to reveal any more ignorance on my part, so we'll move on. Have there been any polls to find out if Americans have improved their manners since you started your column? And if not, why not?
Well, why not indeed? I hope someone will take one. I hope there's progress being made. Now, of course, if I find there isn't, I don't know how I'm going to go on getting out of bed in the morning. But I have seen myself, this is not a poll, this is just observations, I have seen differences. People do not actually lie down and roll on the floor laughing hysterically when they just hear the word etiquette. They have come to realize that they would like to be treated politely. And the other half is all I'm waiting for when they realize that means they have to treat other people politely.
What are the most frequent questions that you get, and are they different from men and women?
I am sorry to say that the most frequent question I get from men and women alike, because it concerns an event that involves both of them, has to do with sheer greed. How can I extract money or the equivalent out of my friends? How can I, because I'm getting married, make them pay for my mortgage? How can I have them to dinner at a restaurant and let them know that it will be X dollars a head? How can I make them give me what I want instead of using their disgusting taste in giving me a present, and so on and so on. I get these questions constantly, and I am repulsed by them. I keep trying to bat them down. But that is the, unfortunately, that is the etiquette question of our day. How can I make a profit out of my friends?
What should one say to a dining companion who is chewing with his meal with his mouth open? What if this is your father-in-law?
Well, what if it is? I have a very sad piece of news that applies as much to me as to anyone else, which is that correcting other people's manners when they have not asked, I wait until I'm asked, is rude. It is even ruder than chewing with your mouth open, which is rude enough.
Is it proper to read a newspaper at the breakfast table when a house guest is present, when it is the fourth morning that that person is still there?
Am I correct in detecting a certain sense of desperation over the fact that it's the fourth morning? The newspaper at the breakfast table, no other reading is allowed at any other meal, is under the heading of mutual consent. And by the way, one of the things that the newspaper industry could do to encourage better manners is not to jump stories from one section to another. If two people are reading at the breakfast table and somebody's reading a story that jumps into the section the other person is reading, we have an etiquette crisis.
I'm sorry, there are a lot of questions we're not going to get to. Before answering the last question, I would like to present you with a certificate of appreciation.
Thank you.
For appearing here today. The traditional press club mug.
Thank you.
Keys to a 4-year-old Pontiac? No, that's not. A book, Ion Washington, by New York Times photographer George Thames. Oh. The presidents who have known me.
Thank you very much.
And the final question is, dear Miss Manners, how well versed in the correct way of doing things should we be before one can begin to break the rules?
When I'm going to welcome you to my stage, you'll hear about it. Thank you.